Hi, and welcome to episode 11 of Learning Grounds. My name is Zach Chase, and in this episode, we talk with Jessica Alzen, a researcher and graduate student at the University of Colorado Boulder. Great conversation in this episode about teacher assessment, specifically Colorado's teacher assessment project. For those of you who don't know, Colorado recently said that 50% of all teacher evaluations need to be based on student assessments and left that open to interpretation. So we talked to Jessica a little bit about how we find that data, what we use, and how we keep people in the middle of that process. Not an easy thing to do, but incredibly important. We also talked a little bit about her time as an online instructor and how her practice shifted from her time as a face-to-face classroom teacher. Really interesting conversation. If you want to follow Jessica online on Twitter, she's at J-A-L-Z-E-N. That's it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of Learning Grounds.
It's not recording.
Oh, it is. It is recording. I know what I'm doing.
Well, the numbers weren't.
I sort of know what I'm doing. I'm not entirely sure. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Thanks for sitting down with me.
Yeah.
So, what are you drinking?
Raspberry Zinger tea, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
From Celestial Seasonings.
Yes.
Keeping it local.
A local.
Mm-hmm. I've got Major Dickinson's blend from Pete's Coffee, which is nice to have your coffee named after a cannibal.
It is good. That's how we like to name things around here.
Jessica, what is it you do?
I do lots of things.
Like if I were a stranger and
you're
like, hi, I'm Jessica.
Okay.
Hi.
So I'm a graduate student at University of Colorado Boulder in the Research and Evaluation Methodology program, second year.
And you do a bit of teaching.
Yes. Okay. So I have two jobs involved with that. I teach a lab section for quantitative methods 1 and 2 to first year doctoral students. And I'm currently working on a project for a local school district in Colorado in their teacher evaluation program.
And you teach a class online?
Oh, yes, I do. I teach a class online as well for the university that I came from in California. And I've been doing that for about 6 years now.
What university?
California Baptist University.
Cool. What are you learning?
So I'm learning about lots of things. Let me see. So one of the big things I'm learning about right now is how difficult it is to like design and implement a statewide teacher evaluation system. So that's one of the projects I'm working on. And just a lot going into that I didn't necessarily expect before I got put on the project. And just all of the logistics that are involved in that and how many like small logistical cleanup things have to happen before you can even start talking about actually rolling things out and making things happen.
And do you mean that from like a math and structural standpoint, or do you mean that from a human capital standpoint?
Well, currently I mean that in a like, how clean is your data set and what can I link to people or not link to people? Particularly, I'm talking about like a student test scores to teachers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So which teacher should a student link to or not? How clean are those links? How many students does a teacher have linked to them? How many should they have before they're included in an evaluation system, and all of those sorts of things.
Is it a school evaluation system or is it a teacher evaluation system?
This is the teacher evaluation system that I'm working on. Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that, as I read about this, and you are much more knowledgeable than I, art teachers.
Right.
How do you connect those?
Yeah,
like
so
how am I evaluating an art teacher when I don't have an art test?
Right.
And I don't necessarily want an art test.
So the program that we're working on, the state of Colorado is requiring that all teachers have 50% of their evaluation be based on some sort of student outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So for some teachers, this is super easy. They can use your statewide test, but it's required that it be multiple measures. So for some teachers, it's easy. You've got your statewide test, you've got a district test, you've got your local assessment, and we can use those all in conjunction, and that's fine.
Local assessment being like classroom assessment?
Uh-huh, classroom or school. However, the districts or the schools get to decide how that works. And then, yeah, you do have these other courses like art, PE, et cetera. And so we haven't necessarily gotten to that part yet, but the conversations that we've had have been things like the school or the district would decide on what a student outcome would be. So maybe it would be a portfolio for an art class. Maybe it would be a skills assessment for a PE class. That there's sort of trying to figure out that out. Mm-hmm. And then this particular evaluation system also has a part built in where it's like across a school. So it has to be in some way fostering teamwork across the school and across the disciplines.
Okay.
So at a high school, for instance, it would be graduation rate. And so the school, all teachers in the school will get a score for something like that.
So the component of that 50% of that percent basically is tied to graduation.
If that's the way a school decides to do it. Okay. There needs to be one that is
across the board.
Yeah, that builds community amongst the teachers. Otherwise, there's concern that teachers would not want to collaborate any longer because, you know, if I share with you, but our scores are going to be dependent and I want to make sure I do well, then I don't want to share with you, sort of thing. So they want to make sure that they're not building a system that fosters that sort of attitude. So we're working to try to figure out how can we build the system to not do that.
Right. That sounds really difficult.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a project for a while. I just started on it this month, and so I'm still just learning the lay of the land kind of thing. But yeah, it's pretty difficult.
One of the pieces because when I was in Pennsylvania teaching, they just have done a similar gig, and they've said a certain percent of the school-wide test scores count toward individual teachers. Mm-hmm. And so that in conversation has come up with, well, it's going to make it really difficult in a high-achieving school. Like, you've got a buffer there for your low-achieving teachers,
right?
Your worst teachers are going to be more difficult to remove because they've got some, like, bonus points, like extra credit for turning in something with their name on it, basically.
Right.
So that just sounds really, really super complicated. Were you a classroom teacher at some point in time?
Yeah, I taught middle school. I taught 7th grade math and English and AVID for 6 years before I came here.
And how does working on this project run up against your sensibilities as a teacher? Because I can see, to some extent, the logic behind it, right? As a, like, well, we need to find out what's going on. I get that. But the classroom teacher in me just bristles at the idea.
Right. So, I mean, my kind of personal opinions that I'm developing since I've been here, like, I think that standardized testing has a place, and I think that it can be really informative in kind of giving us flags or markers for where there's really strong instruction and where there's possibly really weak instruction happening, and to be what guides where we spend maybe more of our resources to investigate what's happening. But I'm pretty uncomfortable with a lot of the high-stakes decisions that are solely based on student outcome measures like that.
Because, I mean, I'm going to keep interrupting you. Just so you know.
It's fine.
Well, because, I mean, as we've been looking at in classes, like, socioeconomic status skews that, right? So, like, really quality instruction is going to look like it happens a lot in the suburbs, right?
Well, it depends on the model that's used for, well, this is a contentious topic, so.
Yeah.
So.
That's okay.
I mean, there are some who would argue that you can control for those differences by using prior achievement. I'm working on a paper right now that's talking about that. That if you take into account a student's prior achievement, then a lot of those differences, student individual characteristics, will kind of parse out of that teacher evaluation. There are some people who don't agree with that, but a lot of the literature is showing that it does do a pretty good job of controlling for those things.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's also why a lot of these evaluation systems are coupling those student outcome measures with more subjective, you know, rubric or observations or more subjective evaluations of what teachers are doing. So like a survey of students or a parent opinion survey, those sorts of things are also going into that mix to try and capture sort of the variability and what it does make a good teacher.
Mm-hmm. So the high stakes, it's kind of like, this is good because it gives us a place to look, but it's not necessarily what we should be basing some of the decisions that are getting made on these things.
Yeah, my current opinion is that it shouldn't be the decision maker.
Right.
And
so where do you lop that off, though? I mean, there's that implies that there's a bar where you're like, well, it can be used to make decisions up to this point.
Right. Well, so kind of my probably naive thought process on it is that those would be used literally to identify where are teachers that probably have the best practices, where are teachers that probably have the weaker practices, and then sending instructional coaches or sending principals or sending peer teachers into those classrooms to either learn from good teaching or to come alongside and provide better professional development for those teachers who are struggling. And so to me, it would be a low percentage, if any, in an actual teacher evaluation. But that's not where the politics and the practices and the policy is really going right now. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of resigned myself to a lot of my future work probably being to try and, you know, stop the floodgates.
Right. Then that was going to be what I was asking. It's like, so you were in, as a researcher, right, and as somebody who's going through a doctoral program, you're moving to a position of authority where you could affect that kind of change, ideally, right?
Hopefully.
I mean, that's
right,
what...
Right, that's why we're here, right?
Yeah. So how do you feel you're going to be prepared to do that? I mean, I'm a year behind you in the same program, and I'm not necessarily feeling like we're getting a lot of training on the here's what policy is and how you can help change it side of things.
Right. Well, so kind of a discouraging experience that I've had a lot in other researchers I've met in my field is that I've really heard a lot of people say, we told them, be worried about this, look out for this, hey, this is maybe not a good idea, and decisions are made otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of disheartening. I don't know what necessarily to do about that when, you know, the dean of my own school of education says those stories, and she's, you know, a big name and all of those things. But, you know, I hope that I would be doing some work in that direction that would be helpful. So, for instance, in that conversation about what about students who are coming from different socioeconomic statuses. So often, whether a student qualifies for free or reduced lunch is what's used as an indicator of low socioeconomic status.
Right.
And a wide variability of students fall into qualifying for free and reduced lunch.
Right. And sometimes it's not even qualifying. It's those who take advantage of it, right?
Right.
So, I mean, you don't even have a full net on,
right,
on that one.
Right. And so I'm actually just starting, like, we're working on a grant to move forward on some research in that way to hopefully start to build some more intelligent theory on how we define socioeconomic status and how we control for that in our models, and hopefully working toward something better, maybe more like median household income and parent education level and parent a household income indicator versus just qualifying for pre-reduced lunch, or the number of people living in a housing structure. You know, those sorts of things, to get more nuanced.
So it would kind of disaggregate that big grouping of free and reduced lunch and pull it apart and say, within this we also have levels to understand as well.
Yeah, and that's an area that I'm actually really hopeful about. I'm really excited about starting that research. Like, that's something that I see as I could actually do something that contributes in a way that would be, you know, beneficial and helpful in that. And this work that I'm doing with designing the teacher evaluation to hopefully be able to talk about those sorts of concerns as much as possible. I mean, that's going into effect soon. There are some districts that are already doing that, obviously. And the paper that I'm working on to present at a conference coming up is about, like, what if this non-random sorting of students, the ability levels are not randomly put into classrooms, what if that's affecting value-added scores as well? Like, those are
the
sorts
tracking,
of things.
Right? That's tracking? Non-random sorting?
Sometimes it's tracking, it's tracking based on different variables. It could be ability, it could be ELL, but we're even talking about, like, when a principal favors a teacher that he likes and so doesn't give them, you know, students that are more difficult to teach versus, you know, even just...
Or believes strongly in that teacher and gives a disproportionate number of difficult students.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, looking at, okay, what does that do for a teacher's value-added estimate? Like, that sort of work. So those are the kinds of things that my work is starting to aim toward. You know, will I make a difference in the world? I don't know, but it's at least in a direction that I feel like is in the right direction.
Well, and it's interesting because this, to me, sounds so also qualitative side of things, right? Because if you say, okay, go in and randomize the student assignment to teachers, then you're changing culture at the same time, right? So so the implications in a quantitative measure might be, oh, look, this, if we shake this up a little bit, we've got less kind of group segregation within a school, but you've also changed just the operation and how the school sees itself as maybe an identity, or how the teacher sees it, him or herself as a teacher in the classroom.
Yeah, and there's just so many things that are involved in that. So, for instance, I'm working with some data from Los Angeles Unified right now, where there's plenty of schools where close to 100%, if not 100% of the school is an ELL population. Mm. And so what does tracking look like at a school like that versus a school that's more, you know, white dominated or even just multicultural, more evenly multicultural,
right,
kind of thing? Like, the it's just so nuanced and different.
Well, and do you break it down by like emergent ELL and like emergent ELL?
Right.
Do you take it all the way down to that level, and do you shake kids across? Using shaking kids up, I don't know why, but do you do that to make sure that they have different levels? And is that the best thing for the students at the same time? Right.
Right.
Because
right.
You're trying to balance a fair measure against what's right as far as education and learning.
Right. Right. And then you have your whole big slew of if it's a fair measure or not based on so many different things.
Right.
And that's also a big, you know, point of contention in the measurement field and education in general. And so,
I want to shift gears now.
Okay.
Online teaching.
Yeah.
Something I'm doing for the first time this semester. But it's a thing that I've experienced before. Like, I've been a student in an online program. Mm-hmm. And really saw all the things that I disliked and bristled at. Because I have an idea of what good teaching can look like, and online didn't give that to me. This program was very much an out of the box. Here, Pearson has created this curriculum, and we've hired people to deliver this curriculum, kind of thing. So, how do you approach it? I'm guessing it's not out of the box curriculum.
It is more out of the box than most would expect, I think. So actually, when I started teaching, I taught on the ground for this university when I lived in California.
Okay.
And then the program I teach for is actually, it's called Online and Professional Studies, and it's particularly geared toward people who are working adults or coming back to school. So mm-hmm. There are very few traditional college students that come through this program.
Okay.
And so a purpose of the program was to what kind of flexibility can we provide to give access to more people to college education? And
okay.
So they shifted toward hybrid and online courses. And so after I'd taught this class on the ground for a couple of years, they approached me and asked me to create an online curriculum for it. So the way that it's an accelerated program, the way it works is all the classes are delivered in 8 weeks.
Okay.
And they do come with a lot of the curriculum is boxed. So in that, these are the standards for this course. This is what will be covered in the course. These are the major assignments that anyone who takes this class at the university, whether
okay.
it's online or face-to-face, they will do these big benchmark assignments. And then what's left to the flexibility of the teacher will be how they present the material through like lectures or PowerPoint or podcast or video, whatever. And then, you know, if you want to have like smaller assignments or assessments and those sorts of things, those are left more to the independence of the instructor. But the major skeleton structure of the course through this program is actually out of the box.
And how do you be personal in there? I was reading actually a couple hours ago a piece from the New York Times on a professor at University of Virginia. They've recently had a bunch of back and forth on all the Ivies are ahead of us on online learning, and then so they deposed their president and they brought her back, and now they've signed on to Coursera. How do you mimic or get close to the face-to-face experience in an online environment? Or is that how you approach it? Because sometimes I think maybe that's the opposite of what we should be doing.
Right, and I mean, it was a challenge for me. So when I started teaching online, I was really frustrated with my own teaching because I didn't know how to translate mm-hmm. what I did well in the classroom face-to-face with students to an online environment. And so it was really difficult for me. I mean, it started off with really just having, I spent time like with personalized email and really being involved in discussion boards so that at least my voice would be apparent as the students are interacting with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Making myself available through Skype and chat rooms so that if students wanted to have that interaction with me that they could. But not many took advantage of that, and so it was really it was really frustrating for me. It was really turning more into a job and a paycheck than
right.
than an experience that I enjoyed as a profession. And so as I've spent more time teaching this online, I've worked more to try to incorporate you know, like voiceover things, video, working more toward initiating a student toward a Skype conversation with me as opposed to just talking through email.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that I am really personable in interactions that I have with students as much as possible. And then I also make sure that I design assignments where they have to talk with each other. So a teacher writing course, and it's a intermediate level writing course. So I make sure that the students learn how to do, you know, using things like Google Docs or live text where they are working with one another, or working through groups kind of thing, making sure that there's activities where they do have to like talk with one another, so you're not just on an island by yourself as you're in this online class.
So creating some artificial structures toward community.
Yeah.
And what did the students say? I mean, what's the expectation there? Because I also felt like when I was in my program that there was not an expectation on behalf of my classmates that it would be any better than it was. And I mean, there's a lot of a lot of criticism, a lot of federal policy is moved around, like the University of Phoenix doing it kind of poorly. And people accepting it because they thought, well, I got the degree, so that was what I was there for.
Right. Yeah, and so that has been difficult. To me, I take it very seriously of my name will be next to that grade and next to that course on a student's transcript. Mm-hmm. And so if I don't feel as though the student has met the rigor of the level of those course objectives, then they won't receive the grade that they think they want. And this is a private university that I'm working at where people pay a decent amount of tuition. And so I have definitely run into issues of entitlement or feeling like, you know, I've paid for this course and I've gone through the motions and so I should receive a passing grade. Mm-hmm. And so that's difficult. I really work at the beginning of the course to talk about, you know, these are the objectives for this course and these are the things I expect you to learn at the end. And even though we're online, you know, I want for you to have an authentic and real learning experience. I still am struggling through, you know, how to really convey that because it's just not the same as a face-to-face course. And you never know like what the how people are receiving a video that they watch as opposed to a live person in a room where you can react to facial expression and reactions and those sorts of things. So it's still something that I'm struggling with, but you know, trying to make it an active part of the course as I'm teaching it.
Where did you look, if anywhere, for kind of help on the improvement of your practice with online teaching?
I'm good friends with several of the people who teach in the same program, and so we've created online groups together where we'll share our materials or talk about things that we're struggling with. The dean of my department actually got his PhD in online education, as well as the associate dean, and so both of them are really supportive in providing lots of training for us, like online modules and training in different applications, et cetera, that we can implement in our courses. So it's actually kind of built into the program in a lot of ways. Like they knew that they wanted this to be a good program, and so they want to provide as much training as they can to their faculty as we move to more and more online and more hybrid courses.
So taking that back down to the K-12 level and the initial conversation about assessment and evaluation, I mean, online courses in my mind are different animals than a face-to-face course. Are we treating, I'm not as familiar with the Colorado law around this, but are we treating those differently? Or are teachers who are teaching in online environments going to be assessed in the same way that we're assessing teachers in face-to-face environments?
Yeah, you know, that's not something I actually know about. I'm not sure what the situation is in Colorado or how that, I can't really speak to that.
But it would be interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
for sure.
Because there are some similarities that line up and some that won't.
Right. I mean, ultimately, let's say we have a situation where there's a student who's expected to learn the Colorado State standards, whether online or face-to-face.
Right.
I mean, ideally, they're the same standards regardless of your implementation.
Right.
So
the student assessment portion of it, right?
The
50% coming from student assessment makes sense. But this calls for me into question the other 50%.
Right.
Like, what you've got this list of, here's what an effective teacher does.
Right.
Are those the same across platforms? And I'm using face-to-face, I guess, as a platform.
Sure.
Are those the same? Should they be the same?
Right.
Have you watered down your expectations so that they can be applied to face-to-face and online learning?
Yeah, no, this is actually a really good question, one that I'll bring up at my next meeting, actually, because I didn't even cross my mind to think or ask about that.
I haven't thought about it until I just said it out loud.
Oh, there we go.
Maybe we're the first two.
Maybe.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So talk about so you were at this school teaching these courses before you came to Colorado, teaching as a master's student? If this was a kind of side gig while you did a master's degree, or
So I finished my undergraduate degree, started teaching middle school, and started my master's degree at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
No, I was an intern and did my teaching credential the first year and then went straight into a master's program. And as soon as I finished my master's program, they hired me to teach undergraduate.
The same place where you had gotten your
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Student again, right? Last year, mm-hmm. you were a student mm-hmm. in a very real sense, right? I mean, this is, you get thrown in and any sense of kind of power that you may have had, right? I mean, this I'm applying my own experience to yours. But, right, that kind of functioning as an adult who's done this thing and is in a career and then pulling back to being a student, has that been an experience that you've had? Or is it, oh, no, this is, things seem to be pretty much the same.
No, I would, yeah. I mean, I left teaching. One of the reasons I left teaching was that I wasn't necessarily feeling challenged anymore, and I wasn't feeling like it was maybe the best use of my skills.
Okay.
And so my wanting to come to grad school was to continue to build on those skills and to be able to explore other opportunities that I wouldn't have necessarily had available to me prior.
Okay.
So yes, absolutely. I went from walking into work every day feeling very confident in what I was doing to definitely not having that feeling as often now.
To asking people to be like, to tell you,
right,
here's
yeah.
what you've done wrong.
Right, yeah, yeah.
How does that mesh in your brain? I mean, how do you deal with that shift?
It's okay. It's okay most of the time. Because I came with that attitude of I want to be a student and I want to learn and I love to learn. And I just really looked at coming here as a great opportunity to be learning from people who are leaders in the field.
Okay.
Who are doing, you know, this work that's advancing the field in a field that I learned very little about prior to being here. And the more that I learned about it, the more that I knew I wanted to gain access to that and understand more about it. So most of the time I really do look at it as different, but not necessarily negative. It's difficult to be in a situation where there are days where I truly don't know what I'm doing mm-hmm. again. So that's, you know, hard in a lot of ways, but I'm always able to say that I'm thankful for it.
In those moments, I wish I could be with my students again. Mm. Because I feel like there's a level of empathy that is so immediate when I sit down to complete an assignment that I'm just boggled by. And I just want to go back to the students and say, me too. And do you remember how you had no idea what I was asking you to do? I can't do this thing. And God, it is painful.
Yeah, when I was an AVID teacher, when I went through school, I didn't know anything about AVID. Mm-hmm. And then I started working as an AVID tutor when I was an undergrad and then became an AVID teacher. And so they teach this Cornell style of note-taking. And mm-hmm. I learned old school Roman numeral.
I love Cornell notes.
When I went to school, it was old school Roman numeral 1, 2, mm-hmm. 3, ABC, all that. But now, because I taught Cornell notes. I use Cornell notes when I take notes during class mm-hmm. and I go back and I write my summaries and all those things. And I often want to be back with my AVID students to tell them, like, look, Ms. Alzine does it too.
I'm doing it.
Yeah. I promise it works. It's very helpful for me.
How do you keep that relevance then? Have that sense of relevance, right? Because there's a difference between being here in a research institution, even if your research is happening at the school level mm-hmm. and being day to day in a school.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so part of my fear is, what teacher is going to listen to me?
Right.
Right? Because there's the perception as a classroom teacher of people in research institutions. I know it because I had it. So how do you work against that? Or is
Yeah, that... it's a real fear. I mean, and the more years that I'm out of the classroom, the more that I think that. I mean, I still have good connections to the people I used to teach with and the district that I used to teach at. And I know I could walk back to that place and get a job. But I know the more time that goes on, the less and less that would be a reality. And mm-hmm. and likely the less and less that would be a reality of what I would even want.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard. I mean, it's hard to... I feel like you... Oftentimes research trajectories are more applicable to a classroom level and others are not. But ideally that research would ultimately trickle down and affect a classroom. Mm-hmm. I guess I hope that makes sense. You know, so like
ideally,
right? Ideally, you know, like so when I'm talking about the work that I'm hoping to do in how we define socioeconomic status in teacher evaluations and student evaluations, you know, hypothetically, that work would ultimately impact students and teachers in a positive way, and it's not necessarily going to be on the curriculum and instruction level or on a day-to-day level in that way, but this age of accountability is so big and strong right now. It's a pretty driving force in a lot of classrooms. And, you know, I would hope that I would do work in assessment that would make better assessments, that would drive better instruction, those sorts of things. And those sorts of ideas are what motivate me. You know, so I don't know that I will ever do work that's directly at the classroom level. And I don't know. Who knows? I might end up working for a district.
Right.
You know, who knows where we'll end up in 5 years kind of thing. But I guess I just have to think about what good could the work that I'm trying to do and have that be my motivation, because otherwise, why am I here?
And do you ask? I mean, this has been a question that's come up, because I'm curious about how we ask students into conversations about policy.
Mm.
Do you see yourself driven, or are you is there a voice in your head that says maybe we should ask teachers in on this as we're talking about how we're assessing them?
Yes. I believe that the project that I am currently working on does at one point, or had at one point, involve teachers in the process. I mean, obviously it did to some extent when the state was writing their evaluation system,
right,
as a whole. And then as individual districts are choosing how they're going to implement that, I believe it's involving the voice of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, there are the powers that be who are not,
right,
the teachers.
Well, and so, oftentimes the teachers who are in that room are either those who are disgruntled or those who have been chosen to be there, right?
It's not, right.
It's in the middle of that spectrum,
right?
Those who are showing up and doing a good job every day,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but maybe you have to get home and take care of kids or have other responsibilities, they're not in on that process.
Right.
So you have those who are like, oh, I'm going to go ahead and say yes because I'm expected to say yes. And those who are like, all I'd ever do is say no. So I'm going to come up to this process and say no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something that I mean, it's been sort of more of a side interest to me. I haven't done much to pursue it, but something that I've had a lot of conversations with people about is we've done a lot of reading where I've felt like people have tried to cause this divergence between teachers whose test scores are good and teachers who show culturally competent or culturally relevant teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really,
and that those aren't necessarily the same,
right,
groups?
And that they have to, and that they are divergent. It's the way that it's been presented to me anyway.
Okay.
Like I haven't seen where do those two groups.
So you can
meet.
Either be culturally relevant or you can have good tests.
Right.
Those, and neither the two shall meet.
Right. Is really the feeling I got from a lot of the things that we've been asked to read in the program.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're, like I said, this side interest that I haven't done much to pursue. I've encouraged other people to pursue it. But it's just this idea of, okay, let's find those culturally relevant teachers who also have good test scores, and let's find out what's happening in those classrooms as opposed to the ones where these seem to be necessarily separated things.
Mm-hmm.
To really see, to get a better idea of, okay, there's this spectrum of teachers who are producing good test scores by whatever means, maybe good, maybe not so good. Then there are these teachers who are doing great things by connecting with kids culturally. Where can we have both of those things meet together, and what does that look like, and what does that mean for education reform, really? I mean, in a lot of ways, I think the things that I think make good teaching now that I might not have thought a few years ago are not the things that I did when I was in the classroom and I thought I was a good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things that I think our education system as a whole needs to really think about, and I'm more of the pessimist in thinking that maybe those things won't really happen, but what part can I do in my research to try and, you know, move that mountain just an inch kind of thing?
Right. Well, and it's interesting because as you were explaining that, I also thought about what do I feel like you can influence in a teacher,
mm-hmm.
right? So I feel like we've paid a lot of attention to how can you get teachers to have kids who have good test scores, right? There's a lot of information out there of,
sure,
do these 41 things,
right,
and you're teaching is going to be great, score-wise. And I feel like maybe because of that's the preponderance of literature that I've been exposed to, or maybe it is my just personal feeling, that's easier to teach.
Mm.
And it's easier to get teachers to get kids to get good test scores,
mm-hmm.
than it is to get teachers to change how they approach culture.
Right.
Right? This is the one is so deeply embedded, and the other one is so... can so easily be thrown to, well, we're just counting and measuring things.
Right. Well, and it's not necessarily part of teacher education programs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, teachers are taught how to write a lesson plan and how to write an assessment,
right,
but they aren't necessarily given a lot of instruction on how to be culturally relevant The things I've seen, granted only a few schools, but still, the way that cultural relevancy is taught or assessed for student teachers just isn't emphasized as much. Even in this evaluation program that I'm talking about, there is an element of cultural competency and teachers being evaluated on that, but it's such a small part in comparison to the bigger picture. And I think that there's not enough attention paid to the connection between culturally relevant teaching and student outcomes.
Right. Well, and this was Richard Elmore's point about reorganizing schools is not going to, is reorganizing the system alone isn't going to do it, because even like setting a bar higher and just telling teachers teach to it doesn't build their ability to teach to it, right?
Absolutely.
And it's like taking the kid who's never run before and saying, go do hurdles. All right, now do them better.
Right.
Why aren't you doing them right?
Right.
You
right.
know what? We're going to cut you from the team. Right. and that coaching piece becomes so important. Mm-hmm. And we have so much money for coaching, which is the nice part.
Mm-hmm.
Money for coaching. Where would you go? Like, are you thinking in research institution?
Oh. well, so today, if I was going to build out the rest of my career today, I would love to be able to do some work with this theoretical defining and use of socioeconomic status in evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to do some work overseas and applying that same research in another country.
In another culture.
To see how those, you know, match up and then do something with those findings, you know, whether they're different or the same. And then just because I've kind of been told that the way it works is if you want to be in academia, you probably want to do that first kind of thing, because you need to have this constant
churning out of
cycle of publications and work and research, etc.
Yeah.
And then if you go to do something else, you don't necessarily have the opportunities for that, and then there's this hole in your vita, and then it's hard to get a job sort of thing.
Right.
So, I mean, currently that's my plan, but there are days where that absolutely terrifies me, and I think it's too stressful, and that's not really where I want to be. I mean, I often have meetings with my advisor and think, what happens when I'm the one sitting on that side of the table and there's, you know, some bright-eyed grad student on this side looking at me expecting them to teach them something.
Right.
And that's scary. So I'm not sure. I mean, when I originally started looking at graduate programs, it was because I wanted to be a director of assessment in a district, and I could have gotten that job without a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
There are some PhDs who do that job, but there are plenty of districts who have directors of assessment who don't have the level of education that I have now, even.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, it just kind of depends on where the cards fall, I guess.
You said something that is not related, but I want to ask because it's occurred to me as interesting, is comparing cultural applications of what you're talking about, the research you're doing, within the country.
Sure.
Because I grew up in Illinois, I taught in Florida, I taught in Philadelphia, and then I studied up in Boston, and now I'm here in Colorado. I've seen different slices of the country.
Sure.
I would imagine that, culturally speaking, we have enough diversity in here to make this a really important conversation.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the things that, like, the national curriculum is going to be what it is, and I think it's not going to change a whole lot in what goes on in the classroom. But national assessment practices, a little more terrifying, because that cultural relevance is almost completely impossible, right? A test to a student in rural Illinois and a test to somebody in, like, West Philly, those are... How are you going to do that? You know, like, so studying that would be really interesting.
Yes. There's a lot of things to say in response to what you've just said. Okay, so...
That's my goal.
So my motivation in doing this overseas comparison is because of things like these international rankings of education systems that we see, where the U.S.
Heard
has
of
kind
them.
Of,
yeah.
you know, dropped quite a bit. And so
we just stopped trying, I think, is pretty much the reason.
Right. So that's kind of my motivation in wanting to look at it in other countries in that way, is because of that, you know, is really the U.S. doing so terribly, or is, you know, is it just fundamentally different in all these different places?
Right.
Of thing? That being said, I do think that doing that same work within the U.S. is absolutely fascinating. The paper that I'm writing with that L.A. district data, we're actually waiting for permission to hopefully use a Colorado district as well, to be able to talk about, okay, here's sorting in Los Angeles, here's sorting in this district in Colorado, and then talking about the different effects in those two situations.
Because you have similar language situations, but different cultural situations.
Right, so for exactly what you're talking about, like that's what we want to be able to do with this mm-hmm. paper. As far as testing and test construction goes, I have had very little instruction on that as of yet, but I do know that there a lot of work goes into hypothetically making test items. It's this thing called differential item functioning, and it's essentially, you know, saying that if this item functions differently for people who are from this group versus this group, then we don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, a lot of work does go into that, but again, linguistic issues in testing and all those sorts of things is also a big area of research. And so I think it's just constantly this, you know, chasing after the best kind of assessment.
Right. And then, you know. And then on the classroom side of things, one of the pieces that I observed is I worked so hard as a classroom teacher to make sure that what we were doing seemed relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sat down to the test, which had kind of been tested and controlled for those pieces. So the test was so boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's...
You know,
totally legitimate. Yeah,
they were so used to coming into school and having at least a sparkle of relevance to their
right.
lives.
Right.
And then, well, if this doesn't operate across cultures, we're going to take it out of the mm-hmm. of the assessment. And then you get left with things that are
bland.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
How do you like the right. school was doing a really good job? Maybe it didn't come up on the assessment because
right.
the
right.
kids were
right.
like, ugh.
Right.
And then you have to tell the students, well, this is how we get our money, or this is like, right, that's how it becomes often in schools, is teachers saying like, well, if you like me, try.
Right. Yeah.
That is not a relationship right. that should ever be bred in a
right.
school.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, hypothetically in these programs, bringing in a district level or a teacher or school level assessment is what would hopefully capture those things and include those in that. The problem is, again, who is making the decisions on how much each of those assessments weigh on your ultimate
right.
score and all those sorts of things. We actually haven't gotten to that part yet, so I can't tell you anything about what I know about that. But
it's okay. I've finished my cup of coffee.
I have finished my tea.
Which is traditionally when this podcast ends.
All right.
So we're done now.
Okay. Well, thanks, Zach.
But thank you for doing this. I think at some point in time, I will probably ask you to talk some more.
Okay.
Because I'd like to get some... people who are focusing on quantitative and people who are focusing on qualitative and do a bigger group to talk about these things. So,
oh, all right.
For you to be there on that one as well.
That would be fun.
But thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Learning Grounds. I'm Zach Chase. Our intro and outro music comes from New Dance Boys Mission, and it's called Intro. It's licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Learning Grounds is also licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. I dare you to say it 3 times fast. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.